Yesterday afternoon, I'm Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this Worldview Wednesday edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and we're going to be talking about some very interesting subjects on our program today. I mentioned that it is the Worldview Wednesday. That is sponsored by World Magazine, and we're so grateful for the folks over there at World Magazine, the good work that they do, and then for sponsoring the program here on Wednesdays as well. By the way, I'll tell you right here at the top of the broadcast, you can go out to my website at www.knowingthetruth.org, and if you click on the link in the right-hand column, you can get 74% off the current price of the World Magazine delivered to your home every other week. And so I just want to make sure you're aware of that as we start the program today. Going to talk about an interesting subject today, the subject of self-governance. Let me read to you a blurb on the back of a book. It says this: today, Americans are united in the belief that the political system is broken, that politicians are corrupt, that neither major party has the answers. Add to this the growing disdain for the unholy alliance between the largest corporations and our government, and there's a lot of frustration festering in our country. Some of us are ready to give up, and some of us are ready to scream a little louder, but all of us believe that we can do better. Americans don't want to be governed from the left, the right, or the center. They want to govern themselves. The American desire and attachment to self-governance runs deep. It is one of our nation's cherished core values and an important part of our cultural DNA. It's what makes our nation special, and right now it needs to be saved. And that's a brief statement on the back of a book called In Search of Self-Governance. It's written by Scott Rasmussen, and Scott is our special guest on the program today. Scott is the founder and president of Rasmussen Reports. It's an independent media company specializing in the collection, publication, and distribution of public opinion polling information. You probably have seen Scott many times on Fox News and other places as well. In fact, he has a very good article in yesterday's Wall Street Journal. I hope to talk to him a little bit about that as well. It deals with the subject of healthcare and some of the polling he did on that important issue. With that, let me welcome Scott Rasmussen into the Knowing the Truth radio programs. Hey, Scott.
How are you? It's a great pleasure to be here today.
Well, great. Enjoying your book, enjoying this subject, and enjoy the work you do there through Rasmussen Reports. Let's start off right here in the beginning. You talk about that this is an extremely important subject, the search for self-governance. Tell us why you wrote this book and why self-governance is something that we really need to be thinking about and talking about today.
You know, when the country was founded, there was a recognition that there was a need for government, but that most of the way that a society was governed was through the actions of individuals. Government was there to play a supporting role. And nowadays, when the media talks about politics and government, we only talk about the formal powers of government. Mm-hmm. And there's a group of people in Washington who like it that way. They want to rule over us rather than go back to our heritage of self-governance. What I think we need to draw more attention to is this broader view. Americans make the most important decisions of their life, decisions about their faith, their family, their jobs, where they're going to live. They make those decisions themselves when society's working well. And then when things need to be done in the community, they get together with neighbors, and whether it's a food bank or a Habitat house or a Little League team, people chip in and get things done that need to be done. Even in matters of business, we govern the way businesses operate by responding as consumers. When a restaurant is good, we go back, and when it's not, we don't. Mm-hmm. That's what controls a society, not the formal powers of government, and we've lost that flavor in America today.
You mentioned in the book that in this world of Washington, you know, the cliques that takes place in Washington, D.C., that they see self-governance as little more than allowing voters to choose between the two political parties. But self-governance is much more than that, right?
Right. And again, that is the view from the cliques in Washington and Wall Street. There's an elite group there that thinks so you should pick between one team or the other in terms of who is going to rule over you. And again, what we really need is this broader sense that, you know, one of the things that governs my life is the opinions that my wife holds, because I respect her and want to have, you know, if she thinks something I'm doing is wrong, I'm going to take that into account. When we talk about a society working well, it is giving people that kind of freedom to make those decisions on their own. And nobody in Washington can make those kinds of decisions for us.
You mentioned in that same quote as well that not only do they reduce self-governance to the idea that we just need to pick between two different politicians and two different parties, but you also mentioned that some of the more elite groups there have a much more brazen view of this, and they see self-governance as a problem that needs to be overcome. Do you find that quite often?
Absolutely. In fact, maybe a month or two ago, I was giving a talk at a trade association, and it was before the book came out, and I was explaining some of the basic ideas that, the American people don't want to be governed from the left or right. They want to govern themselves. And the speaker after me, very much a Washington insider, spent decades and is very well respected, he said, you know, it's all well and good that people want to govern themselves, but we can't let them because they're too stupid.
Oh, boy.
And now he was speaking a little more bluntly than most would.
Mm-hmm.
We're hearing some of the same echoes right now in the health care debate that people just don't understand what's in the bill. When the public disagrees with political leaders, the politicians have really taken to blaming the voters. Something's wrong with them. And, you know, it's a shame because we live in a country that has celebrated that kind of individual freedom and governance throughout our history. We believe as a nation that governments derive their only authority from the consent of the governed. And for the first time, really, in our country's history, we've developed a group of leaders who are resistant to that notion, who oppose that fundamental idea articulated in the Declaration of Independence.
You mentioned that although that concept of self-governance has been clouded in our governing today, and in even with people not understanding that this is how the country was founded, as you mentioned in some of those founding documents, but you point to the fact that we understand the concept because we use the same idea in the market today, in the way that we choose where we go to eat or who we do banking with, or just the way the market works. However, we're also seeing at the same time that there seems to be an attack against the market, against capitalism itself. These two things correspond with each other?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that's amazing to me, it's really been disconcerting in some of the polling data we've seen over the last year and a half. The American people were vehemently against the bailouts of the banks and the auto companies and the government takeover of General Motors. And part of the reason was because people don't like seeing $700 billion of taxpayer money being spent. But part of the reason, as we've gone into it, is it just didn't seem fair. The way that people understand the way our system is supposed to work, our free market system, is when a company does well, companies are supposed to prosper and grow, and when they do poorly, they're supposed to go out of business. But what's happened in America today is the largest corporations, those who are well-connected, when they do well, they keep the money, and when they do poorly, they get bailed out. And that is a problem that people are seeing, is that the rest of us have to play by one set of rules and the elites by another. What we actually see is that the largest corporations, not all of them, but some, especially those that are in trouble and are struggling, fear the free market far more than they fear government regulation. And the reason is because government regulators are far easier on them than consumers would ever be.
You know, I saw or heard a news item come across the other day, and it was spoken about not really as a top piece of news, but they said just very quickly that the government was coming out with a new proposed plan to deal with the people with their mortgages that are now underwater, meaning that they owe more money on their house than what their house is worth. And they were saying that the proposal was for people to go ahead and sell their house for whatever they could get for it, and the difference between what they owed and what they would get for the house would be forgiven them. In other words, the taxpayers would pick up the difference in between. And then, as part of this proposal, they were going to give the folks that sold their homes an additional, I think it was $1,500 or $1,600, to then put for toward other living arrangements or another house afterwards. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, immediately, like you're saying, the sense of you know, that when you buy a home, you know, there's always a bit of risk involved in it, hence the old saying, location, location, location.
Right.
Make sure you buy it in a place that it's going to go up in value and you take care of it. But all of those things seem to be being erased and being hijacked in some sense. It's a major, major shift in what America is all about, isn't it?
It sure is. And you know what, from the beginning on this, we've polled on this mortgage issue, not the particular policy you just mentioned. And I'm not too familiar with that, but in terms of the general attitudes, for a couple of years now, when the mortgage crisis first began, the overwhelming perception was that the biggest problem was that people bought houses they couldn't afford, and that the proper response was for those people to sell their home and move to something smaller. You know, there are concerns if a lender has engaged in some practices that maybe hid the costs and those sorts of things. But
right.
In terms of the general concept, you know, there has never been a cry to redefine home ownership. What there is a frustration about is people were taught, you know, I grew up being taught, you buy a home, you make your payments, and you build equity in it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet right now, because of the housing market collapse, that's not working out. It's another sense of frustration.
Right.
But it's not a reason to upend the basic tenets of responsibility. And I think that's where it gets back to it. You know, people want a fair playing field. They want to know that that everybody is playing by the same set of rules, and they want to be included in the decision-making process, not excluded from it. And right now, that's just not happening. And we see it time and time again. When I talk in purely political terms, and I don't like to do that when talking about the book because so much of self-governance is outside the formal realm of politics, but when we talk in purely political terms, people oppose the bailouts. Well, the bailouts happened. They opposed extending them to the auto companies. Well, that happened. People even oppose the Cash for Clunkers program. They oppose the takeover of GM. They don't think the stimulus package worked. All of these things, you know, are not popular. Right now we have the health care legislation that a majority of Americans oppose. And yet the process in Washington seems to be, it doesn't matter. We need to pass it anyhow. We need to do this anyhow. And there is a lack even of the decency to try and explain to the American people why these things should be good, to take the time to build support. The Constitution was written to slow the process of legislation down so the political leaders could go to the people and build support. And you know, we're moving away from that concept.
Right. I want to talk about those numbers in healthcare in your article in the Wall Street Journal in just a moment. But before we do, I wanted to ask you two more questions about the book. It seems that this unholy alliance that you talk about, you know, with big business and big government together, they seem to be, you know, this formidable force, almost an overwhelming, a David and Goliath type story, where we got the people on one side, and then you've got these massive amounts of money and power running things on the other side. How did this come about, and, you know, what can be done about it?
Well, it's come about over several generations as the government has grown and the ability of government to have an influence on business decisions has grown. So businesses have formed tighter and tighter alliances, and we now have a group of people who shift back and forth between corporate suites and government offices. It's not that anyone had a plan to do something evil. It's been a natural evolution of a process. But having said that, it is a difficult challenge, and it is difficult. You know, people ask me sometimes, you know, what are the three things we need to do to fix this? And I wish there were an easy three-step solution or a 12-step solution, but there isn't. This is a challenge that we need to be aware of. One of the things that I'm trying to do with the writing is to help people think through the issue in a broader sense of self-governance. We need to call for more transparency, and we need to be very clear on what the possibilities are. But ultimately, there is no clear path that makes it very easy to say, here's how the good guys win.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an optimist. I believe it will happen, and I say that because people have been beating the odds in the United States throughout our history. I give the example, I take a page from the Star Wars story and remind people that Luke Skywalker had to redeem his father, Darth Vader, to work on the problem from the inside, and we may have to redeem some of those politicians as well.
Mm.
But I do believe that if we continue to draw attention to the problem, there will be solutions out there. I just don't know what they are right now.
I think one of the ways that we can get involved here and make it so it's a little bit more manageable is to constantly be calling for decisions to be made closer to the ground, closer
right.
to where they actually impact people, states' rights and, you know, local governments and these types of things. At least then we can keep people accountable.
Right. And certainly there are a number of things that can be done. One of the things I recommend in the book is that we should extend the concept. When the Constitution was written, the House of Representatives was supposed to approve all tax bills because that was supposed to be closest to the people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we really ought to have voters themselves have a chance to approve any tax hikes to keep some limits on what is being done. I think there are a number of things like that that can help.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be great if members of Congress could vote on legislation from their home district so they would be around some people they're affecting.
Yeah.
And so I don't mean to be to suggest there aren't steps. There's a lot of steps, but there's not a this is not elect this team and everything is better.
Right.
We take all the steps we can to keep the process moving. And, you know, in a sense, it's we need to remind our political leaders and the nation's politicians that the voters are in charge, that we are the chaperones, mm-hmm. and they need supervision.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to take a while. But the core concept is that government works best when it's in its proper role, just like mm-hmm. any other institution. It functions best when it's doing what it's supposed to do. And in a self-governing society, government plays a support role. It is not supposed to be in charge.
Mm. I think many evangelicals, which is our primary audience here, have backed away from politics because they do think it's so slimy. They think that it's, you know, just so corrupt and so out of control that they don't like to get involved in all. But I would encourage them to get involved in the process, to understand what is taking place, and then see what you can do about it. I think, like you were saying, we can make a difference in certain ways, and we need to do that. It's up to us to run the country as the people, and so we must be involved in order to make it work.
And I agree with that. I encourage people, though, to remember that you know, the way you get involved is more important than the result.
Mm-hmm.
If you are an evangelical Christian and you are involved in the process, make sure that you're a good representative of Christ in the way that you act and carry yourself.
Yes.
And don't get caught up in the games that other people play.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get caught up supporting a candidate just as a compromise because you think they're less bad than the other person. I mean, there need to be things we take a stand on that you can believe in our own behavior. matters a lot.
Good, well said. I think evangelicals have learned that lesson over the last couple of years, the idea of lesser of two evils. We've got to think broader than just that being the criteria.
You know, if I could, before you mention health care, and I know we're running low on time, but one of the little-known aspects of the civil rights movements in the 1960s was that Martin Luther King was very concerned about the way that protesters behaved.
Mm-hmm.
And before you could take part in some of his protests, you had to sign a pledge on your own behavior.
Mm.
And the first item on the pledge was to begin the day with 15 minutes of time reading the Bible.
Huh.
Now, he was a Baptist preacher, so that's not shocking.
Right.
But again, his focus was on getting a broader message to a world that was watching, and he recognized that a big part of it was not the words they said, but the way that they carried themselves.
I'm a firm believer in that. I think that historically we've done it with bullhorns and placards, and I think we need to really be educated and speak articulately about these issues, know what we're talking about, and do it in a way that is persuasive and not be turning people off with rough and speech that it just doesn't help our cause at all. So I wholeheartedly agree. The healthcare article that you wrote in the Wall Street Journal, quickly summarize that for us. I think you mentioned in the very beginning there about the public opinion has remained the same over this long period of time. Just give us a few highlights from that article.
Yeah, you know, the thing that's amazing about this is it's been a major issue around the country. The president and congressmen have been out speaking about it and talking about it, and yet public opinion has barely budged. We have done 15 national opinion surveys since mid-November, and in all of them, the number of people who support the plan has stayed in a very narrow range, between 38% and 44%. The number of people who are opposed has stayed between 52% and 58%. And what got me started in terms of this article was trying to think about what is it that the president is doing or not doing that he's unable to move public opinion on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the real key here is that he is focusing on talking about the health care legislation, and voters are looking at it in a larger context.
Mm-hmm.
A majority of Americans, 57% of voters, say that if this passes, it will be bad for the U.S. economy. And one of the reasons for that is they think that increases in government spending are bad for the economy. The president hasn't really addressed that. Another issue is the sense that, and the president is correct when he cites the Congressional Budget Office numbers as saying the plan will be deficit neutral or maybe even help a little bit. But what he ignores is that Americans don't trust projections by the official government agency. 81% of American voters believe that whatever the projections are, the plan's going to cost more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of what we've seen over the past several decades. And because of that, people believe that this plan will increase the deficit, hurt the economy, and increase middle-class taxes. And with those fears out there, it is difficult for the president to rally support for the plan.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad, because I agree with all those results that you get in the poll there. I think that it is going to cost way too much money. I think it's way too big of a bill. We need to pare these things down and do them in some sort of steps. And so I think that that's extremely important, and I hope it does not go through. I just don't think it's the right bill for... I agree that that healthcare needs an overhaul and we need reform. I just don't think this is it in this particular bill.
Well, and that's, you know, what you just said is important. People do want to see reforms. They're concerned about the cost of care. They're concerned about other aspects of our health care system. But doing it in steps has a number of benefits. One of them, very simply, is that people don't trust the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the lines I've used a lot in this last year is our polling shows that by a 2-to-1 margin, people believe that no matter how bad something is, Congress can always make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
And people chuckle when I say that, but when you have a 2,000-page bill that people haven't read, they are suspicious about what's inside. And that suspicion is part of the reason that the bill is unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were doing it in more bite-sized steps that could be easily explained, you would build some trust.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the big story behind this Massa thing that just went down the last couple of days, Representative Massa and all that fiasco that's going on there in Washington again, is that what I think the biggest story is that it is people like this that that are actually making these types of bills. And
right.
That gives me no confidence whatsoever that they are able to do a good job at putting together something like this. So
yeah.
I think the smaller, the more manageable, the more accountability we could build into it, the better, rather than these massive spending bills.
Right. And again, you make that point about Massa. People overwhelmingly believe or they trust their own judgment more than they trust the judgment of political leaders.
Mm-hmm.
They trust the judgment of their friends and neighbors more than they trust political leaders. And that's true whether it's Republican or Democrat. This is not a partisan issue. One of the reasons is because, you know, when you go to Washington, and I firmly believe, by the way, that most people who go to Washington do so with good intentions,
mm-hmm.
but then they're caught up in a broken system and lose touch with any sense of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that most people, most evangelical Christians, if they went to Washington and stayed there long enough, would be caught up in that broken system and would lose touch as well. So this is not saying that they're bad people, but what we have for the most part is there's a sense of the world that most of us live in. We deal with things on a day-to-day basis. We find things we like and we don't like. We do our best to move forward. And then there's a world in Washington which seems to be off, you know, on a different track some of the time.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, Scott, thank you very much for visiting with us today on the Knowing the Truth radio program. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Okay. We'll see you. That was Scott Rasmussen. Scott is the president of Rasmussen Reports and the author of the book that I have here in my hand, In Search of Self-Governance. And so it's very interesting to talk about this important foundational truth in our government that often just doesn't get much airtime. Not many people talking about it. We're going to switch gears in just a couple minutes. We're going to switch and speak to Joe LeConte about his article in World Magazine called A Plea from the Past, A Call for Spiritual Strength. And we're going to talk about the subject of appeasement. You don't want to miss that. We'll be back in just a couple seconds.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
Here's what some are saying about the True Woman Conference.
I knew that God had something here for me.
I'm thankful that God allowed me to hear about the conference.
This is just a new beginning for me.
I'm Nancy Lee DeMoss, and I want to underscore how important it is for you to join us at the True Woman Conference in Chattanooga. True Woman 10 is a call for you to embrace God's purpose for your life. It's an opportunity to link hands and hearts with other women who are also responding to His call. And look forward to connecting to God's heart, His purposes, and His people in a very personal and powerful way.
Come to Chattanooga March 25 to 27 for True Woman 10. You'll hear dynamic teaching from Nancy Lee DeMoss, James McDonald, Kay Arthur, and enjoy worship with special guests Keith and Kristen Getty. Receive a $30 savings if you register now.
Plan to be in Chattanooga March 25th to 27th. For more information and to register, go to truewoman.com.
It's great pizza for a great price. So pack up the family and head over to Stevie B's near Walmart on Woodruff Road in Greenville. At Stevie B's, you'll find friendly faces and at least a dozen pizzas out at all times. Or you can order a pizza and they'll make it fresh just for you at no extra cost. So visit Stevie B's today.
Hi, this is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and I want to take the time to thank John, Ruth, Carlos, and the good folks over there at Stevie B's Pizza for their support of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Words carry immeasurable significance. What would homes, churches, schools, and even the public square be like if we used words with Christian intentionality and eloquence? Crossway has made available The Power of Words and the Wonder of God, which includes essays by John Piper, Paul Tripp, and others, all taken from the messages of the 2008 Desiring God National Conference. The book challenges readers to harness their tongues and appropriately command their silences for the glory of God and the ministry of the gospel.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome back into the second half of the Knowing the Truth radio program. During the first half, we were speaking with Scott Rasmussen from the president and founder of Rasmussen Reports about self-governance. And we're going to switch gears here now and speak to Joe LaConte about his article on appeasement and a plea from the past that appeared out on worldmag.com. This is our Wednesday edition or segment of the Knowing the Truth radio program, and Wednesday is reserved for Worldview Wednesday, where we talk about issues related to worldview, and this will certainly fall into that category. Worldview Wednesday is sponsored by World Magazine, and again, I'll just point out the fact that you can go out to my website at knowingthetruth.org. That's www.knowingthetruth.org, and you'll find a number of things out there. All of the advertisers that advertise on the program, like the True Women Conference. You just heard the ad for that, like the PCRT conference that's coming here to Greenville shortly. You'll hear more about that in just a second. But also, World Magazine's limited time offer is out there on that website as well. And so you can go out there and click on that link on my website, and you get 74% off the cover price for World Magazine. Make a great gift for somebody. And don't forget about yourself, you know, because it's good to be informed and to stay informed about all of these important issues. A couple other announcements before we go to our discussion with Joe here. The first is that tomorrow I'm taking a group of pastors over to Stevie B's on Woodruff Road in order to have a pastor's fellowship together over there. So any pastors listening, or if you're listening and you want to make sure your pastor is aware of this, where I'm buying him a free all-you-can-eat pizza buffet lunch over there at Stevie B's. Plus, for all the pastors that are in attendance, I'm giving them two free complimentary tickets to the PCRT. That's the Philadelphia Conference on Reformed Theology that is coming right here to downtown Greenville. Joel Beakey, Michael Horton, Ligon Duncan, Cornell Venema, those are some of the speakers that will be at this year's event. Don't want to miss it. Those tickets are $125 a piece. I'm giving two of those tickets to every one of the pastors that comes to this Pastor's Fellowship tomorrow, and I'm going to give him a copy of Gabe Flohr's book, Atonement, which will be a great resource for them as they're preparing sermons commemorating the crucifixion of our wonderful Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Also, on tomorrow's broadcast, just very quickly here, Wesley Smith from the Discovery Institute will be with me. We'll be talking about his book called A Rat is a Pig as a Dog is a Boy. It's going to be a discussion about animal rights and how animal rights have gone wrong in this country and how we need to talk about this from a biblical perspective. We'll do that tomorrow on the broadcast. Let's go to our discussion now and welcome in to the broadcast now Joe LaConte. Joe wrote an article out in World Mag, as I said, entitled A Plea from the Past, A Call for Spiritual Strength in the 1940s Offers a Lesson for Today's Appeasers. Joe, welcome into the Knowing the Truth radio program today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Good to be with you.
Joe, can you give us a little bit of a synopsis of what people would find in this article? And then after you give us a broad overview of your point here in this article, then we can start going through it piece by piece for a few minutes.
Sure. I mean, the magazine, Fortune Magazine, in 1940, an editorial, they were lamenting the fact that a lot of ministers, mostly liberal ministers in the Protestant various denominations, even though they had supported America's entry into the First World War in a major way, here they were now in the late 1930s. By 1940, the Second World War has started, and the very same ministers who had urged America's engagement in the First World War were now sworn to a policy of neutrality, and essentially a policy of isolation, and really were not engaged in what was happening there on the European continent. Mm. And doing all their, working as hard as they could, as a matter of fact, forming peace societies to keep America out of that conflict. And the editors at at Fortune magazine couldn't understand what principled reasons they had for insisting that America had no interest in the fight in Europe and the fight against fascism and international terrorism. What possible principled basis could they be arguing from? That was the lament, and at the end of the day, these editors at Fortune felt like there was a real lack of spiritual leadership and even a commitment to transcendent spiritual values, which is what the editors at the secular magazine were crying out for, believe it or not, back in 1940.
Wow, times have changed, huh? I don't think we'd see that same article today, would we?
But you just couldn't imagine it, could you? In a Fortune or a Forbes?
No.
Complaining about the lack of transcendent spiritual leadership in America's churches really was remarkable.
Yeah, you write in this article something that they said. You said that Fortune's lay prophets directed their anger at the nation's religious leadership, saying this, that, quote, we are asked to turn to the church for our enlightenment, but when we do so, we find that the voice of the church today is the echo of our own voices. So
yeah,
the church was just reflecting the society around them rather than leading the way through, as you mentioned there, that they pointed out, the transcendent truths, the gospel message, the absolute truth that we find in the scriptures, and leading the way with thinking through that these types of groups need to be opposed and need to be put down. I think it's interesting in your the picture that's associated with the illustration that's out there in World Mag. It shows, of course, Adolf Hitler, and then down at the bottom it shows Ahmadinejad. And so if we fast forward this argument to our time now, we find, obviously, and I guess this is the point you're making throughout this article, that we find these same appeasement voices, kind of a neo-Neville Chamberlain-type approach to what's taking place with terrorism and evil in our world today. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I didn't make the explicit association to Ahmadinejad there in Iran, but certainly the argument could be made that the way in which the United States under the Obama administration has been approaching the problem of Iran, that it does smack of a kind of a style of appeasement, of doing everything possible, assuming the best possible motives on the part of Iran, despite the mischief and the terrorism they're exporting all over the world and the obvious desire for nuclear weapons and the extermination of Israel. And so the great challenge is, how do you learn from the past? We don't want to just mine the past to make some ideological point, but how do you properly learn the lessons of the past? And I think that's the great challenge for us, Kevin, in this situation here.
Sure.
And I'll just say quickly, and then I'll turn it back over to you, but one of the mistakes that the ministers made, and you put your finger on it, they were just echoing really the rhetoric of the secular political left in the 1930s, which had become completely disenchanted with things like the Treaty of Versailles, very disenchanted with America's role in the world. America was seen as a great problem internationally by the political left, all the problems in America. And they were really echoing that rhetoric and that kind of complaint. But in the process, they were failing to see the real threat on the international stage and recognize really this new political evil, this political theology of fascism. And so they weren't thinking about how to meet it. They were so focused on essentially parroting the complaints of the secular political left.
You know, we find that exact same thing today, the closing of Guantanamo Bay. The only reason that I hear anybody who is promoting the idea of closing Guantanamo Bay is that our enemies have said that they don't like it. And to now take a poll among our enemies and then use that in policy making is just beyond me. And we even have our own senator here in this area, of course, Lindsey Graham, who has bought into this idea and is working hard to close it. I see no reason to close it whatsoever, much less to move them onto the mainland, much less to have the trials in New York City, which, of course, they backed away from all of this now. But all of that way of thinking, mean? I had asked Emily Bells and Mindy Bells, I'm sorry, and a couple of the other folks there from World Magazine when they had been on. I had asked them a question that sounds a little bit shocking when you first hear it, but I asked them if terrorism works, that if you're willing to stay at it long enough and be brutal enough, has America lost the sense of resolve in these types of fights so that if they do this, eventually somebody is going to invite you to the negotiating table, you're going to be accepted as that your view is legitimate, even though you've used this illegitimate means of bringing it to the forefront, i.e. terrorism, I think that we'd have to conclude that it does. Look at Yasser Arafat, look at Sinn Féin, look at what Ahmadinejad, look at any of these other ones that are taking place.
I mean, it's a terrific question. It's difficult to answer. I don't think America, as in terms of the bulk of Americans, the mass majority of Americans, I don't think we've lost our resolve. I think some of our political leadership has lost its resolve. But as usual, I think the mass of the Americans, where they are right now, they could be persuaded either way. I don't think they've caved into the appeasement mindset. But I think we'd be foolish to think that it couldn't happen. Because if you go back to 1938, just a couple of years before this Fortune magazine editorial, I mean, that was the great betrayal at Munich of Czechoslovakia, selling Czechoslovakia into the hands of Hitler and the fascists. And when that decision was made, that was Great Britain was rejoicing, and we should add quickly, the religious left in this country was rejoicing. Christian Century magazine was rejoicing. And, of course, it was the great sellout. It was the great moral amputation. It was the great act of appeasement. So we'd be crazy to think that it couldn't happen here.
Right.
You know, we've got to maintain a spirit and a character of vigilance and education and re-education, which is part of the reason I did this piece for World Magazine. We've got to remind ourselves of the roads that we've been down before so we don't repeat the mistakes of the past.
Exactly. This political correctness that has taken over. We just saw this with Hassan in his terror attack at the base there. You know, we saw the same that some of the people said, well, there were all sorts of signs that raised red flags. And rather than doing something, they actually promoted them. And many people said that they felt that the culture was such in the military that to raise the flags even higher would have resulted in, you know, some sort of reprimand or negative aspect of them. So when we see that that it has risen so high that we can't even say anything about it, I think that it may be more pervasive in our thinking and in our country than we would like to imagine.
Yeah, that's a legitimate worry. There's no question about it. And that was just, to me, and to many Americans, I think, it was such a scandalous episode to see this guy, to know how militant he was, and because of political correctness, to not act appropriately. And then to have that decision, you know, kind of sloughed off and rationalized by members of the Obama administration, it just drives, you know, a lot of people to distraction and to real concern and even anger. So I haven't given up on the on kind of the American middle, that sensible middle of the American electorate yet, and civil society. I certainly haven't given up on the institution of the military. It's one of the few institutions in this country that it seems to me the culture there, the cultural values of that institution are still very strong and very competent. They are grounded in the moral principles of the just war tradition and where they fight battles. I mean, I have just tremendous respect for the American military, the men and women in uniform, what they're doing in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, they are an amazing group still.
That's right.
God bless them, you know.
Yeah, amen, amen. They're doing a wonderful job. It's I guess the problem becomes not only in the secular political left, but more closer to home, especially for this program, me being a pastor and also our primary audience is to evangelical Christians around the country. But the point being that ministers have bought into this. Now, ministers very progressive left-leaning ministers, but nevertheless, those that name the name of Christ. And like, for instance, you note in your article, Reverend Jim Wallace in the Sojourners magazine, shortly after the terrorist attacks on 9/11, produced a manifesto called, quote, Confessing Christ in a World of Violence, unquote. And the document, you write, was signed by scores of church leaders who rejected, quote, the crude distinction being made between Islamic radicalism and Western democracy. You know, that they seem to not be able to say that there is a group out there that their goal is the destruction of Christianity, that they want to destroy what has made this country great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's none of those scandals, Kevin, if I could use that word. I mean, to not be able to say clearly that the enemies that the United States faces in radical Islam, that enemy, radical Islamic fascism, if we want to call it Islamo-fascism, that has nothing to do morally with liberal democratic societies. To not be able to make those distinctions clear by people on the religious left, I think it's a scandal for the gospel. And what makes it even worse, of course, is that they're dressing up this moral equivalence with kind of gospel talk.
Exactly.
And religious language, and that's what I find so outrageous. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to hold these guys to account and hold their feet to the fire. Because the beginning of moral clarity is the ability to at least understand what you're up against, that you're in a war, that there are real forces of evil, and we can call them evil. That doesn't mean that we're perfectly good. Maybe we don't like the expression good versus evil. That's fine. It's still pretty good versus evil, meaning liberal democracies. Pretty good versus what really is a raw, naked evil in what these Islamic terrorists are willing to do. The dismemberment, the torture, the executions of men, women, and children. If we can't call that evil, well, then, you know, the last person out the door, turn off the light, because we're done here, right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And there have been people, during the period that you're looking at here, the period of Nazism and the rise of the Third Reich, there were people that were standing up. Of course, we've got Dietrich Bonhoeffer in his writings that were speaking out clearly. I was reading Martin Lloyd-Jones in some of the sermons that he had preached during the time when England was under attack and everything that was taking place over in Great Britain. And so there, even in our day and age, I've had Dr. Albert Moeller on the program. We actually did one on 9/11, a special broadcast, and we highlighted a chapter in one of his books called All That Terror Teaches. And we looked at the idea that this is evil and we need to be able to call it evil and speak to it for what it is. But for every one of those, as you mentioned, there is this voice of the disillusioned. There
That's
is
right.
this group that feels that American democracy is the problem itself and that capitalism itself is evil and somehow juxtaposed to the teachings of Christ, which is just not true. And we've talked about that on the program before. It can't, it can't be maintained biblically. I think part of the problem, you tell me if you don't think that this is correct, is I think that there is such a low state of understanding about the Word of God itself and the doctrines that are in the Word of God, that people are easily swayed by a simple Bible verse being attached to somebody's statement. It's probably quoted out of context, many times misquoted, but nevertheless, it sounds like a Bible verse, and politicians have learned how to sprinkle that in, and yet it may not be given a biblical concept.
Yeah, I think that's exactly part of the problem, Kevin, you know, the lack of biblical literacy. And I guess what I would add to that as well is that you've got these two tendencies in the Christian world, it seems to me, two extremes. You have the utopian impulse, which is just not quite willing to kind of accept the world, the fallen world, as we find it.
That's right.
And keeps yearning for something else, which at some level, you know, we understand that. We understand that we're made for another place.
Yeah.
We're made for eternity. And so the yearning for something that's not quite earthly is a good thing. but it goes off the rails and becomes a utopian impulse. So there's that out there on the one side. But then on the other side, there's just a cynicism and an unwillingness to see the good in the flawed institutions, in the flawed democracy that we have. And unfortunately, utopians, they will always, almost always, become cynics because reality will hit them in the face.
Yes.
And it's good to be disillusioned because it means you've been stripped of your illusions. But the problem with the disillusioned Christians is they become these kind of carping cynics. And I think we have them in the voices of people like Stanley Hauerwas, who I quoted in the article, who, you know, just really within weeks after 9/11, shortly after the 9/11 attacks, I mean, his lament is, and I'll quote you, is, "I think that when America isn't able to rule the world, that people will exact some very strong judgments against America, and I think we will well deserve it." Mm. I mean, they were still pulling remains out of 9/11, out of Ground Zero,
yeah,
when he said that. Mm. Now, I just find those kind of comments, symptomatic of this utopian impulse run amok, and it becomes cynicism. And I don't see anything really Christian about that. I think it's a sub-Christian impulse.
Yes.
And I think we need to kind of. I'm not calling individuals sub-Christian. I'm saying that way of thinking, that particular way of thinking is sub-Christian, and we need to identify it and bring it out into the light of day.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. As I talk to other evangelical leaders, both on this broadcast through doing over 100 interviews with Christian authors and leaders a year, plus just in my own circles that I run and talk with different folks, I find that many people in the evangelical church are confused, and they think like a discussion like we're having here today, they might consider us to be too much of a patriot, that in some way we're thinking too highly of the United States. We're not under any illusion that the country has difficulties and that there is a lot of sin in this country and all of those types of things. And but in the same sense, we're saying that let's not completely disregard the fact that this country has been called by God in it historically to do wonderful work around the world, within the country itself, in raising up the freedom that we have. We've raised up missionaries and preachers, and we have freedom to read and worship, read the Bible and worship together. All sorts of glorious things that God has enabled us to do because in this country. And we can't just dismiss those now because, as you were pointing out, there really is this difference of worldview between two different groups of people. There are these humanists almost that have viewed this utopian aspect, as you were talking about, and then there are the ones that believe the scriptures, that we know that man is fallen, and we know that we need checks and balances and accountability and all of these things. But this place is not our home in the end. We're looking for another place, a place in glory with our wonderful Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
You mentioned at the end of your article, you say the answer is, the way out is the sound of a voice, not our own voice, but a voice coming from something not ourselves, talking about the voice of God being spoken through his word out into our society. Is that what you're getting at?
Yes, I am. I am, Kevin, on that. And I think what that really does draw us down to, especially on this issue of confronting evil on the international stage, we have to go back to some of the best, moral insights that the Christian tradition has given us about a just state confronting evil and willing to use all tools at its disposal, diplomatic tools, but also the military tools. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the Christian just war tradition. It's a rich, an incredibly rich tradition, and we can't let go of it. We need to rethink it, I think, in the age of terror, no question about it. But we got to go back to those deep, I think, biblical insights into the problem of evil and the responsibility of just states, governments, to address that evil.
Well, Joe, thank you very much for writing this article, and I'm going to tell people about your book here in just a minute, but thank you very much for taking the time out to visit with us on the Knowing the Truth radio program today. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. That was Joe LaConte, who is the editor of The End of Illusions, Religious Leaders Confront Hitler's Gathering Storm. And obviously what he's doing in that book is he is looking back at history and what took place during the time of Hitler and what the religious leaders were saying. And then from there, he is extrapolating out lessons that we can learn today as we're facing terrorism, as we're facing this type of aggression around the world today through terrorism. I encourage you to read that article. Go on out to worldmag.com, and you can find that article out there at worldmag.com. Thanks again to World Magazine for sponsoring the program today. And don't forget about the upcoming Pastors Fellowship tomorrow. Also on tomorrow's broadcast, I mentioned we'll be talking about the subject of animal rights. Remember, all of these issues, the Lord Jesus Christ said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free."
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.
Life-changing teaching and talk for the Carolinas and Georgia. Christian Talk 660. WLFJ Greenville, Spartanburg, Anderson.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lisa Brady.